Hello, everybody, and good night. It's a great pleasure to be here tonight with you, and thank you for the organization for allowing me to present this topic here tonight. And for those who is watching me via the internet, now or in the future, when it's visually impaired, I'm a bald guy with a beard, and the room is a little bit empty tonight, but I'm very happy to be with you all here. And yeah, please. So since our group tonight is small, let's try to be a little bit closer. And during the presentation, if you have some questions, just raise your hands, and I'll be more happy to start a dialogue with you. My name is Lucas Lasota, and I am an academic at the University of Halle-Wittenberg. I'm a postdoc there, but I'm also I also work for the Free Software Foundation Europe in Berlin as a legal project manager. My contact is here. And before I move forward, I just would like to add a personal touch to this presentation because it's the second time here in Lübeck. And 7 years ago, before I joined my first job in the free software world, I was here spending my vacation. So it was in December, and then in January I start working at FSFE. So I'm very happy to discuss with you tonight some topics of free software that's close to my heart. And let's get started. So the agenda for today, I would like to introduce you. I have a legal background. I always have been working with law, and I would like to try to answer the question how we can empower people to control technology via law, right? So there are several ways, and I really love the CCC type of community, which focus on the tech and this interdisciplinarity, merging policy topics, tech topics, and also law, all that together. And today the perspective is a little bit on the law, and I would like to keep this presentation a little bit on the high level. We don't need to go into the nitty-gritty, but just for you to know that there is a lot going on right now in the realm of platform regulation and how free software is connected to all of that. Therefore, the agenda today, I would like to talk with you a little bit about the tech triopoly. I think everybody knows this a little bit, but how three persons control 99% of the operating systems used in the world. Then, I would like to ask ourselves, can we do something against it or not? Or it's a completely lost cause, right? I came with good hope, and I think it's possible to change this. And I have a pledge for device neutrality. And of course, this is also a call for action, and be yourself part of the change. So let's get started. So I think everybody knows the three guys here, right? And think as well. I would like to start asking ourselves here, who uses a smartphone? Raise your hand. Okay, so yeah, the vast majority use a smartphone. And who uses an Android device? Okay, good, 99%. Is there any Apple user here among us? Oh yes, there are. Good. That's also good because this presentation is for everyone using smartphones, you know, so it has some neutrality. But I would like to go over these graphs with you in a short moment. So here are the current distribution of operating systems by devices, right? So nowadays we are seeing that mobile devices, smartphones are the majority of devices being used in the world today. Desktops are of course still pretty much used. But here, for our audience that are a little bit more inclined to open technologies, we can see that where GNU/Linux distributions, they flourished, which more desktops, we have become the minority because now in the world, the majority of people are using smartphones. And the smartphones are a very complex and very serious situation for free software. Because as we can see here, you know, 99% of the operating systems, the mobile operating systems used in the world, they are proprietary. So of course there is Android, which has a very important open source, free and open source part of it, the Android open source. However, Google puts a middle layer, a proprietary one, which is called the Google Play Store, and everybody uses the Android devices nowadays, and they use the Google devices. Think about your YouTube, native app there. And the Googleized operating systems, or perhaps mobile operating systems based on mobile Linux, are really, 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 really only the minority there. There are several there, right? So think about the alternative ROMs that are based on Android, but they are Googleized. There are several of them: Calyx OS, Lineage OS, Graphene OS, you name it, But unfortunately, they are still the minority, right? And what this huge power? This is huge power. Think about billions of people using smartphones on a daily basis, spending their whole time on this. So a lot of power, economical and political power, are granted to these three guys that we are seeing over here. And when they achieve this such massive power, a vicious circle is established. Right, they get the power by imposing this, what we are seeing, but they get their power also by imposing this. So it's a vicious circle, right? And since there are no competition, since there is this monopolization over operating systems, they are able to impose lock-in on everyone. So basically, everyone, 99% of the smartphones users nowadays in the entire world, they are into lock-ins. And what is lock-in? We will see this a little bit later, right? And so they became the gatekeepers of the operating systems, and therefore they can control who is in, who is out, who enters, who leaves, who should distribute the software in the operating system or not, right? And therefore, they can control what we call interoperability, the capacity of the software to communicate each other, right? In the end of the day, what we are seeing in the mobile ecosystems is that we don't have software freedom. So who knows the concept of free software here, free and open source software? Okay, great. The majority. So when we talk about free software, we're talking about four freedoms, right? The freedom to use the software, to study the source code, to change the source code, and to redistribute it. But when we have such massive concentration on digital markets, we don't have this, which is pretty sad. The next question is, why then digital markets are so concentrated? And there are several studies because, the situation becomes so unsustainable that this is not just a topic for, academia or for activists or civil society. This already reached the highest instances in the European Union, and the European Union is desperate as well to do something about it. And we'll talk about the legislative reactions in the EU against it. So it's natural that there is a lot of discussion on this, right? So in 2018, there was a very important study being conducted by the European Commission, where they wanted to understand why digital markets are so concentrated and how we can somehow influence it. So basically, the first reason for this is extreme network effects. Network effects is something that it was very good and is very good because, it allows us to increase the value of a network the more this network becomes bigger, right? So think about if you use a social network or if you use some type of messaging app, you want to be where your parents are, where your family is, where your friends are. You don't want it to be in a messaging app where there is no one to talk about, right? So this is basically network effects, right? And of course, digital markets, they depend on data capitalization, right? And Shoshana Zuboff called it surveillance capitalism, where The entire market is there to capitalize on data, right? And there are some authors, Dan McKillan, who calls that AI is the pinnacle of such surveillance capitalism, and we live in a fascist society because, we live on a surveillance, on a society that is constantly being surveilled, right? And with that, and the neoliberalism and this completely submission on the search for profit leaves also the extreme precarization of work, right? The gig economy, engineers having to work as Uber drivers, right? Because, now we needed to lower the costs and increase the rents. So this study, which was conducted by the European Commission and has been also not only by the European Commission, but academia has been very much deeply involved on this, demonstrated how to, since these are the elements that enable such concentration digital markets, perhaps we needed to start tackling this, right? And today, my presentation, although I deeply recognize the importance of these two topics here, I will concentrate on the first one. Otherwise, we will have to spend the whole night here to talk about this. And I would like to start tackling this, that big tech and this three, there's the three, but big tech is also there on other ones, right? They hate competition, right? They don't like competition. They want to be monopolists of their own area, right? When we talk about Apple, they are monopolist on devices. They are vertical integrated. When we talk about Google, it's all about search engine ads, capitalization on data. When we talk about Amazon, it's all about cloud computing nowadays. So and they have a history. They have a history for anti-competitive behavior. And although competition law is a topic for nerds in the legal area, I like very much one professor in the United States called Tim Wu, which says that the lack of competition in the market has also led to the lack of democracy in our societies, right? Because these companies became so big, and without competition, they literally dominate the markets and therefore dominating how politics are made. So I think everyone uses some digital service nowadays, right? And every time that you click on the terms of services, right, when you submit yourself to these terms of services, some people call that actually these companies, they are the actual legislators, because we are submitting ourselves to their terms of services and more than the type of legislation that we are submitted. In any case, these companies in the last 25 years or 20 years, as I put the dates here, they have surmounted millions and billions of euros in fines already, only here in the European Union, for anti-competitive behavior, which prompted the European Union to think about a different approach, because they said, look, if we only deal with these problems via competition law, we really need to, to think about another system, because just imposing these huge fines is not working, right? And therefore, they started to think about regulation, not only, because here is the difference. Competition law waits for the problem to appear. And when it appears, then they started to investigate, and it takes a long time, So competition law is very reactive. It takes a lot of time to impose this law. And when we talk about regulation already sets a list of do's and don'ts for companies to follow, right? So think about the pharmaceutical industry, think about transport, think about companies that deal with critical infrastructure like the electricity, the water. They all regulated industry. But the digital was completely free from regulation, right? When we talk about regulation, the digital is perhaps copyright protection, perhaps content moderation. It was lacking until 2024 deep, like hardcore regulation, a regulation for infrastructure, saying, look, operating systems are a key part of infrastructure, mobile app stores are a key part of infrastructure, installing and uninstalling software is something that is necessary for our society. Interoperability is cool and it's necessary for democracy. This situation changed with the Digital Markets Act. The Digital Markets Act is it's a law intended to regulate the digital sphere. In the sense. And therefore, it applies to what's called core platform services, which is controlled by these companies, right? So the law applies to online search engines, social networks, but the hero of our presentation today are operating systems, but also app stores and cloud services. And what is interesting for us tonight? So basically, the law has it's a big law, it's a huge, it's a monster, but I listed some of the articles here. For an example, the obligation to allow app uninstalling and changes to default setting, obligation to allow third-party app stores and sideloading. Sideloading is basically, installing anything that you want directly from the internet. Obligation to allow interoperability and obligation interoperability between messaging apps. This sounds pretty basic, right? Perhaps one will say, look, we really need a law to this, yeah, I also ask myself, if anyone has installed, or have interacted with the free software community and has installed, any GNU Linux on your computer, these are by default. We even don't question, we just go there and install and uninstall and do whatever we want. But unfortunately, this is not the reality on digital markets. And these guys, what they did when this law came into force, they viciously react against this law, viciously. I quoted some headlines here. The DMA is a threat to American speech innovation. So this law is, and Meta trying to pursue Trump to fight European Union looming antitrust fine. Here was, the guy gave President Trump a huge present of gold. And this is the, the inauguration of Trump and we know those faces there, right? And therefore, what we are seeing here is that, in the end, these very simple obligations are not very simple. They're effective. They are indeed, they're shaking, and they are messing with the most powerful and most rich and the richest people in the world. Pretty cool, huh? Yeah. So, and then perhaps you say, yeah, nice. Then, yeah, we have a law and, everything should be fine, right? Here I have to, unfortunately, to break your heart, because having the law is just a first step. Enforcing the law and consolidating these rights is very different, a different story. It's an uphill battle. It's something that takes ages. I'll give an example. 3 weeks ago, I was European Court of Justice with our lawyer representing the FSFE there. I was with one lawyer alone, and Apple had a team of more than 10 lawyers in the other side, And so when they interpret this, they try to find the most suitable interpretation that actually, if we're gonna listen to them, they will completely change the way that the law is applied in the sense that then you say, yeah, okay, so perhaps we should not have software freedom at all, right? So, and that's perhaps the beauty and the problem with law. There's always two interpretations, right? So we cannot say, yeah, my interpretation is the only one viable. We have to fight for it. We need to convince judges. We need to convince regulators. We need, to convince, in the end, the civil society that our interpretation perhaps is better for their interests, right? But here, therefore, I would like to propose to us a concept a guide that perhaps may help us to navigate in these troubled waters of platform regulation. It's called device neutrality. It's a concept that we have been promoting. Device neutrality entails that our devices should be neutral in relation to the software that they run. Our smartphones, our laptops are general purpose computers. We should be able to run any software that we want, right? Therefore, we need to ensure software freedom with our devices. When we have this, we are able to break these lock-ins, which we are now, unfortunately. And then we will be able to empower end user control of our data, and perhaps we will be able to change this vicious dynamics of digital markets nowadays. This concept is not just a philosophical one. We have been quite active on this, the Free Software Foundation Europe. We have been interacting with regulators for 4 years right now, and we have been presenting this studies and reports and going into regulatory meetings and submitting our position, trying to convince people in Brussels that we need to change this for the better, for the sake of user freedoms. And I would like to give some examples how things have been working. I would like to give you three examples. The first one is our legal battle against Apple. Then I would like to also talk a little bit about our administrative intervention against Google and our public campaign against Microsoft. So when Apple was designated a gatekeeper under that law, because that law works like this, the European Commission should designate to which companies this law will apply, and then to which services, right? And then the law start applying to them. It's not an automatic law. The first thing that Apple did was to appeal this decision already to the court and say, I don't want you to be a gatekeeper, right? And they had the most interesting in my life as lawyer argument, claiming that interoperability is against human rights. I never saw that, but this is quite interesting. They are saying that interoperability impedes Apple's right to property, right to conduct the business, right to contract, which is questionable, I would say. Nevertheless, therefore, they are asking that the DMA should be cancelled altogether. They say that this law is not compatible with the human rights framework in the European Union, and we should just kill it. And but we have a different mind. We have a different opinion. We do think that interoperability is inevitable as society grows. You know, we need interoperability to break these lock-ins. We need to your devices talk to mine, and we need to make that. We need to make installing and uninstalling of software cool again. You know, perhaps for people that do not have this contact of with free software, they think that just downloading a software from the App Store is already enough. But we wanted to install different operating systems, right? We wanted to go there and do our stuff. We don't want it to be locked in. And therefore, we said that Apple, we are claiming to the court that Apple is being regulated due public interest, right? So we are intervening on this case in the side of the European Union. We had the court case, the court here, I'm sorry. We are waiting for a decision here, and hopefully it will be all right. Talking about installing and uninstalling of software, in July, we were in a workshop organized by the European Commission, where the European Commission put these companies together with several stakeholders, including civil society. And there in this workshop, Google claimed that it is possible to uninstall all the apps that you have to install under this law from your smartphone. But it's weird because I have an Android phone, and there is a set of pre-installed apps in Google that you cannot do anything with that, you know, and it's very hard, right? So in this workshop, Google presented several definitions of uninstalling, you know. So for them, there is a grade of uninstalling, right? And then we said, no, it's too much. Uninstalling should be completely removing the app, not just disabling it or anything else, right? So we submitted it together with civil society's formal complaint against Google to the European Commission. We haven't still got a position on this. Hopefully, we'll have. And last but not least, what Microsoft does? Microsoft controls very tightly how device manufacturers install and uninstall their operating system, right? So I'm seeing here there are some people with Windows devices, and I'm not sure when you bought your devices, it came already with Windows pre-installed. Yes? Okay. So when Windows is pre-installed on your machine, it comes also with the price of this license, and this license is, yeah, it's not very expensive, but you know, you can buy a coffee with that. So it depends on 40 euros until to 150 euros, right? And then basically they impose it on you, and when you uninstall Windows, you cannot have this money back, which is pretty unfair, and therefore. Together with volunteers in Italy, we started a campaign called Refund for Freedom, where we want people to have their refund, their license money back, right? There is a volunteer at the FSFE, it's a hero. The guy, we need to do a statue for this guy. This guy is suing all the equipment manufacturers out there, and he is going after Lenovo, Acer, and all of them in order for them to return the license fees. There was a very cool process where Lenovo, you know, brought heavy artillery, legal artillery, and started to appeal all these decisions for a 40-euro license. And they started to appeal. In the end, the judge said, I think Lenovo is not being acting in good faith, and imposed a fine of 20,000 euros on Lenovo, and the guy donated 15,000 euros to the FSFE. There has been a lot of very cool histories out there, very cool legal battles, very cool actions being taken in order to promote software freedom. But yeah, enough of talking, and I would like to finalize my presentation prompting you to be part of this change. I would like to encourage you, to nudge you, to also fight for the right of having free software on your device. As I said, this is not something trivial. This is not something that we can just say, yeah, I don't care. Because when the most wealthy and the most powerful people in the world, they are reacting against this, perhaps you should also yourself be part of it, because we are changing the power structures in our society. And how you can help? First, your support enables our work. If you are searching for an organization that you want to donate, you want to contribute, you want to support, feel free to donate to the FSFE. We are a completely non-profit organization. We depend on donations. But you can also spread the word. You know, you can leave this room and start thinking about talking with your friends, your family, and to say, look, perhaps we need to do something about it. Perhaps next time that I buy a new device, I'll try to buy a device that enables me to install GNU Linux. Perhaps I can search for a smartphone where I can de-Googleize my life. Perhaps next time that I will use a cloud computing system, you know, perhaps I can search for non-profit ones. In Europe, there are a lot of them, you know. Perhaps, you can try to do a digital detox and then to talk with this with your friends and with your networks. So this is what I had for us tonight, and I thank you very much for your kind attention. Yeah, all right.
Thanks for your talk. As far as I understand, the European Commission is the one who gives the final judgment, no, in these kind of cases? Or who's judging over it?
So this one is the European Court of Justice. Mm-hmm. So, and this one is the European Commission.
Yeah. And then maybe I would be interested in what do you think, or how do you judge the European Commission to be constituted politically? Like, on which side are they? And are they, because I like, in my simplified mind, it's like the EP is like sometimes on the side of the people, but the EC is more on the side of the money. But, or can you say anything about that?
It's hard. The European Commission, sometimes it's hard because it is a very large organization, and they work on different agendas. And our job as civil society is to identify people or teams that out there that internally they can, be on our side. It's very hard to judge the European Commission as a whole. Although we, the Free Software Foundation Europe, when the European Commission, one second, yeah, when they lean, for an example, some time ago, there were some rumors that the European Commission would not like to impose, to enforce the law because they were afraid of big tech, and then we together with civil society, we put a position out there and say, no, you have to enforce this law, now it is time to enforce this law, right? But on a pragmatic level, I will give a very, very concrete example. We were in Italy because one of our activities called Router Freedom. We want also to liberate routers. And inside the regulator, there was a network division and there was a consumer protection division. And the network division is kind of aligned with the telecommunications company. But the consumer protection division was quite aligned with our demands. So then we paired with the consumer division and, submit our position to them and then let them fight internally. This happens also in the European Commission. I'm very happy that in the DMA, in this topic here, we have been having a lot of openness with the dialogue with the European Commission. I think there is a momentum. They understand the gravity of being dependent on big tech. And therefore, these teams here, they are pretty much aligned. And I feel very comfortable in cooperating with them. I also recognize that it's not like always like that, and then in several occasions, civil society have to take a step not to collaborate with the commission, but to oppose what they are doing. So, I would answer like that.
Yeah, with the Apple case, they're known for distributing hardware with software. They operate close in cooperation with certain companies. In the past, it was Intel, for example. Now they have their M-line chips. When they say interoperability is against human rights, this can refer to, I want Linux on my MacBook. But how is it? Is it somewhat of their vector that they say, I don't want that macOS is run on some consumer machine we don't sell. That's one part which I'm interested in, and the other part because they configure their hardware in close cooperation with others, which part does that play in their understanding of the law?
Yeah. I'm not sure if these particular topics are being discussed on this court case. So this court case is more on the Apple App Store, you know, and but in general terms, I don't remember seeing these very topics being discussed there. But I understand your question, and I don't want, we, Def SFU, we don't want to, you know, step on anyone's toes in regards to freedom of contract, freedom to private property. You know, companies, they are completely free to choose their partners. So, as you said, right, they can choose their chip manufacturer, the chip provider, the hardware provider, right? However, the law says that your freedom to contract, this freedom to choose where your device should be used or not, should not impede others' right, right? And what is happening nowadays in digital markets is that, the rights of these companies in order to control how device should be used are impeding us, consumer, to use our own devices, right? I think that more or less, I'll give a concrete example for us, which type of discussions we are having there. I'm without my phone here, but yes. So do you know NFC chip, right? That we use for payment, we use for close communication, right? Apple was denying access to this chip to free software payment systems. So GNU Thaler, for example, when they wanted to use this chip on their own system, in their own alternative system, it was not working, you know. Or the functions that work seamless with Apple Pay, for an example, when you start using GNU Thaler, it was not possible. So basically, Apple was gatekeeping access to chips, you know. Another example, Apple does not allow alternative app stores to function on iOS. Very recently, now there is an alternative commercial free software app store called OutStore, perhaps you heard there. But even so, they are not completely independent. Apple still controls the sideloading process. You know, so although you are installing via the alternative app store, Apple is controlling the back end of it, you know. So currently there is none. There is no alternative app store. So everything goes via Apple, you know. So they don't allow you to sideload, basically. Another example. There are some functions in the operating system, software functions, that enables you to control power management or, you know, the performance of the chip. And then Apple was also denying this to emulators, free software emulators. You wanted to run Linux, for an example, on your iPhone. You know, emulators is very important for developers, right? Because then you can emulate some environments on different machines. But then you could not. Apple was not allowing this. You know, so this is the type of freedom restrictions derived from freedom to contract. Apple can choose. Okay, so you enter, you don't enter. You know, and this type of it was impacting how we do, how we have access to software and hardware features, and this is the type of discussions having in this court case. Although I recognize that again, and I would like to stress this that. Yeah, everyone should have this right to decide their own business partners, unless they are stepping on their one's toes. Yeah, I hope I answer a question.
In your talk, you mentioned that social networks are also there, that they have big tech controlling them, and there's like a movement called Safe Social. Do you have more insights how it's going now in the European court? Mm-hmm. If there are any, I don't have the word. word?
Development
yes,
in this.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you have?
Yes. So personally, although I'm associate researcher at the Weizenbaum Institute in Berlin, and there we have a team working for social media networks. And therefore, I will limit my comments very to, I'm almost a lay person when it comes to social media networks. Because with social media networks, there is a complex layer on the top of everything that we just talked. And this complex layer is this. Different from even, not different, but even more striking than other elements in the digital world, social media networks is all about network effects, you know. And these network effects are very powerful. And then, therefore, you really need to find ways to regulate this. The DMA, it has a sister. This law has a sister. It's called the Digital Service Act. And the Digital Service Act aims to regulate the content layer of the internet. The Digital Markets Act aims to regulate the infrastructure layer, and the Digital Service Act the content layer. And therefore, this type of information that we share on social media, the content that is being shared there, is subject of the Digital Service Act. There are a lot of going on the social media environment. And civil society is pretty much involved as well, right? So, for example, there is the Fediverse, where we're trying to decentralize the power over social networks with distributed systems, right? So think about Mastodon, think about PeerTube, and think about all of the elements that this protocol enables us to do. And when Elon Musk bought Twitter some years ago, everybody thought that, well, there will be a massive, movement that everyone will go to Mastodon. But there was, and a lot of people went to the Fediverse. I'm very happy. Well, X is still there, right? So, and this is because of networks effects. Sometimes we can have the best technology, but even so, you know, sometimes people just, act like that, you know. So anyhow, there's a lot going on, and I invite you to check the work of people at the Weizenbaum Institute. They have been doing great work in the area of social networks. Okay, cool. Again, you are very kind, and thank you very much for your attention.